Welcome to another episode of The Amazing Places. My name is Dean Murdoch. I'm a former municipal councillor, and I created this podcast to celebrate people-centered, dynamic places and spaces. I read recently that Saanich is making changes to Prospect Lake Road. And if you're not familiar with it, it's a rural street in the capital region near, you guessed it, Prospect Lake. Because of the rural, quiet, windy nature of the road, it often gets treated as a bit of a thoroughfare, sometimes even a bit of a racetrack. In response to concerns from residents about speeds and safety, Saanich commissioned a study to assess some of the changes they could make that might slow the traffic down and make the road a little safer for users. I invited my guest today to come on the show to talk about some of those changes and how they might result in improvements that benefit the entire community. He's a road safety expert and the author of the book, No Accident. Please welcome Neil Arison.
Hi, Dean. How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks so much for joining.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So I'd love to hear a little bit about this book of yours. You are an expert in road safety and literally wrote the book on the subject, No Accident.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, No Accident, Eliminating Injury and Death on Canadian Roads. So I wrote it back in, it was published 2014. Although, you know, published in 2014, but really a lot of things haven't changed, sadly, since that time. So the contents of the book actually are still very much relevant today. But I wrote it because I felt like there's many other issues that get a lot of attention, as we all know. But, you know, road safety doesn't get a lot of political attention. There's a lot that we can do. I mean, it's not a so-called, you know, wicked problem, as some social scientists talk about, that, you know, when there's a problem that, you know, is very hard to tackle. But road safety is not like that. We actually have the solutions, and we have evidence of what countries are doing. We can actually eliminate and reduce and ultimately eliminate the number of people seriously harmed by our roads if we wanted to.
The solutions are in our hands and in some cases are extremely accessible and probably don't come at a huge cost, at least cost to taxpayers. If particularly when you compare that to the cost in terms of lives and the cost to our health system for some of the serious injuries and fatalities on our roads.
Two things. You're right. We actually can't afford the current situation. In most countries, road crashes cost 2 to 3% of a country's gross domestic product, right? So what's actually unaffordable is the current situation when we look at the true costs across all levels of government, society, crashes. And then the second thing is, yes, we can actually start with things that are almost zero cost, making better decisions in the beginning when we build roads and design roads and cars and speeds. We can do we can reduce vehicle speeds at speed limits at really low costs.
Speaking of reducing speeds, I read recently that Saanich, the district of Saanich, has put together a collection of upgrades, changes on Prospect Lake Road. Some of those changes include reducing the speed limit on Prospect Lake Road. So I wanted to check in with you on that because I know you'll have an appreciation for the difference that that's going to make. Are you familiar with the what Saanich is proposing out there? And do you want to tell us a little bit about the effect that it might have?
Yeah, I think that, well, first of all, for listeners, the Prospect Lake Road is a, you know, a rural road that is, you know, two lanes, and each lane going in the opposite direction, kind of like a classic rural road, but very narrow, very hilly, very curvy, you know, goes around Prospect Lake. We're hearing about from, I guess, the mayor of Saanich, who lives on Prospect Lake Road, is that it's actually increasingly a shortcut between people traveling from Peninsula to the West Shore. Right. I mean, rural roads are bad anyway because of the opportunity for head-on collisions, which have a high likelihood of resulting in fatality. And then you've got, you know, increased traffic on it because of the nature of the road. It kind of, you know, is perceived as some as a, quote, fun road. So they may be traveling even faster on it. Classically, you know, in many countries, they wouldn't even build rural roads like this anymore. All rural roads would be divided with a center median so that head-on crashes, are not possible. The things that they're talking about doing, like reducing speeds, absolutely, that's going to have a good effect. the center line rumble strip, you know, so that when a car crosses the center line or even begins to cross the center line, that rumble strip will cause vibration and noise and alert the driver. So I think that a lot of the measures that they're doing are going to be, you know, widening the shoulder, having amphibian crossings, all of the things that they're talking about, and eventually some, you know, intersection upgrades and that kind of thing. You know, they're all really good. The biggest one, or the biggest two, I think, would be reducing vehicle speeds and having separation, like a center median, so that head-on collisions can't happen. But, you know, that's expensive. That's really only warranted when you have faster speeds at least 80 kilometers an hour and higher. If we have lower speeds, then we don't need the expense of a divided road.
The reduced speed can often be controversial, particularly among drivers. There's often a kind of visceral reaction to the idea of slowing down the traveling speed for vehicles. What is it about slowing down that is so important? You characterize that as your number one intervention that you'd recommend on a road, particularly in this case, a rural road. What is it about slow speeds that is so significant? Why is that your top priority?
Well, because at the end of the day, you know, all trauma, all injury and fatality results from the kinetic energy, right? The moving energy. And so we have lower speeds. You still have accidents, but you actually would hugely, exponentially lower the amount of injury to people. And I guess the other part of it is, we know from over 100 years of driving and motor vehicles that drivers will make mistakes. You know, we're kind of fixated on, oh, we got to get drivers to drive better. Well, we've been trying that for 100 years. Unfortunately, it doesn't really work. And there's lots of research that shows that even if drivers stop doing egregious things, driving too fast or driving under the influence of alcohol, most accidents would actually continue to happen, because a lot of them, believe it or not, are just human error for various reasons. So we have to stop this path that we've been going down and think differently. We actually have to design cars and roads differently, and speeds. Speeds is the center of it all. You know, the right speed for the right road. If we have lower speeds, we will drastically reduce injury to people, even if accidents continue to happen.
There's some research that shows the rate of speed and the likelihood of the pedestrian who is in the collision, the likelihood of their survival. And that rate drops dramatically, even with a 10 kilometer an hour increase. Am I correct in that? That's why speeds are so important in this equation, that the human body just is not capable of withstanding that higher velocity?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the research is really clear that the difference between dying at 30 when hit by a vehicle going 30 kilometers versus going 50 kilometers an hour is about 5 to 8 times higher at 50. So you're 5 to 8 times more likely to die from a vehicle hitting you at 50 than you are at 30. Very compelling. And in the UK, published in the British Medical Journal, they did a 20-year time series study. So they tracked data over a 20-year period, and they looked at the intervention of traffic calming, and they found it was associated with a 42% reduction in road casualties, especially among children. And, you know, when I wrote my book, I talked to Professor Danny Dorn from the University of Sheffield. And one of the things that he said, which left an impression on me, was if you invented a drug, a pharmaceutical that gave you a 42% reduction in a disease, you would make a fortune. And so here we have, you know, we have the ability to implement traffic calming devices. We could achieve a 42%. They did it in the UK over 20 years. That's pretty conclusive. And they had a 42% reduction in injuries.
And it's an intervention that comes at a fairly insignificant cost. I mean, really, the difference in your expenses are going to be the addition of new signage and, I guess, probably enforcement.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we have to establish a speed limit anyway. So we haven't put up signs anyway, and sometimes we go the other way, right? We spend a lot of money to rip down signs to actually increase speed limits. And a number of jurisdictions have been doing that. But even so, even if, yeah, we're incurring an expense on some signs, it's a rather low cost. The return is rather high, you know, when we measure the cost of the injuries that we could avoid. Yeah, I don't know why. I guess to your point earlier, like, why is it so controversial? I guess people sometimes like to drive fast, but when we think about the needs of everybody, pedestrians and cyclists especially, they don't actually want cars to be driving fast to be safe and feel safe. And then we know that in cities, and even in rural cities, like depending, like semi-rural, I mean, over long, long distances, yes, you might save some time if you're going faster, but if you're lucky enough not to crash or somebody else doesn't crash and clog up the highway. But in cities, actually, evidence is pretty clear that you're not actually saving much time at all. It's very negligible. You know, we all know, right? We're riding our bikes and we're passed by a car and, you know, we actually catch up to them the next red light anyway. This happens all the time. So in cities, the value, or in these semi-rural settings, like Prospect Road, for example, which isn't really that long of a road, the time savings and going a little bit faster just really isn't there. Especially, it's not there to justify the cost in terms of injury again and death.
To say nothing of the environmental impact of that acceleration and the fuel that is required in order to burn, to get the engine going that quickly, only to end up stopping, you know, 500 meters down the road at the next traffic light and to find yourself in parallel with that cyclist or the other drivers who you thought you were going to pass.
Yeah, that's a good point. Climate change as well. Higher speeds not helping. We people sometimes think erroneously that, you know, they'll get there faster so they'll be burning less gas because they, you know, they're traveling for less time, but that's not true. You're burning much more gas. When Richard Nixon was president of the US, the energy crisis in the 1970s, right? And he lowered speed limits in the United States to 55 miles per hour. We actually know, researchers have since, you know, looked at what that actually resulted in, and it resulted in a lot of lives saved. And then following that, of course, that law was eventually revoked and U.S. states were given the permission to increase speed limits again. And one study found that that increase in speed that followed was attributed to an additional 12,545 deaths and 36,583 injuries between 1995, when the law was revoked, 2005.
Wow.
So thousands of people could have been saved. We actually kept, or had the United States actually kept, the 55 mile per hour speed limit.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking a little bit about what may provoke that reaction that we were talking about. Why, you know, if people understood the effect that it has by just slowing down, the cost in terms of lives lost and serious injury would be so dramatically improved. I think partly that discussion, those facts are missing from the debate around slowing down the rate of speed. But I think it's also so culturally embedded. Full disclosure, I own a vehicle. I drive my kids to school sometimes if we're not using our bikes. Neil, I think you own a motor vehicle as well. Mm-hmm. So we're not anti-car. It's not that we're not drivers. But I think that this perspective that is so embedded in our culture, this automobility, is really sold on the concept of freedom. And it's the ability to move without any kind of constraint on those freedoms. And I think a reduced speed limit somehow represents an infringement on that perception of freedom. In the same way that I think that people react to the inclusion of bike lanes, you know, the removal of a vehicle lane to create more road widths for cycling lanes. It somehow is perceived as a threat to that freedom of automobility. What's your view on it, Neil? I mean, do you think that we're witnessing a change in that cultural attitude? Or are folks coming around to a different idea about how cities ought to work? Do you think we're coming around to a different idea about what freedom looks like and how people choose to move?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I had a professor who said there's two kinds of freedom, right? Freedom to and freedom from. So people certainly want freedom. Well, some people want freedom to go fast, but a lot of other people want freedom from injury and death, freedom from climate change, freedom from the idea that you don't feel safe when you go out walking and cycling. I think around the world, I mean, we're seeing a lot of evidence, right? You know, we had the 20s Plenty for Us movement started by Rod King in the UK. Now millions of people in the UK now in 20-mile-an-hour zones, right? Which is about 30 kilometers an hour. And that movement continues to grow throughout the world. And we're seeing lots of communities right here where we live, Victoria, Sydney, has 30-kilometer downtown. Beacon Avenue, of the 40 kilometer in Victoria. You know, it's growing. We're seeing more and more communities, right, lowering their speed limits across Canada, across US and the world. So I think as people start to talk about this more and get exposed to what the research is showing and these newer ideas that it is taking on, and we are actually, you know, it's going to be a little bit slow and there'll still be resistance by some, but I feel like we are moving in the right direction.
One of the things that was neglected for a long time in road design was the acknowledgement that not everyone is moving by automobile, that our streets were built with wide lanes, multiple lanes in each direction, and in many cases, little consideration for the pedestrian, and in most cases, yeah, almost no consideration for cyclists. Well, you know, our mode share is a little more, is a little different than other parts of the world. In Greater Victoria, we have a significant share of cyclists and pedestrians. That's not to say that, you know, there isn't a large number of those folks all over the world and in communities where they were not designed into the fabric of commuting. And there's so much extra work now required for retrofitting our communities to ensure that we're making space for people who are on the bus, people who are walking or cycling or using their scooters or hoverboards or whatever else the case may be. And now we're incurring quite a bit of infrastructure cost in order to make those changes.
When we look back at, you know, the history of cities, right, back to like 1900 to 1930, it's all about the car. I mean, there's lots of books written too on automobility, right, in the first half of the 20th century. And a lot of it was the car. And it was about vehicle throughputs. The engineers called vehicle throughputs, moving as many vehicles as can per hour, and vehicle speeds. So we had actually lots of things that are wonderful, like the pedestrian scramble, right, where an intersection is red in all four directions for cars, and pedestrians can cross in any direction, including diagonally. It's exclusive. This is excellent design. It's very safe because a lot of pedestrians are hit by right and left turning vehicles. Well, we had pedestrian scramble back in the 50s. You know, I have a photo of it on Hastings and Granville in Vancouver, but they were all over North America. These were all systematically removed because we wanted, the emphasis at the time, including in the 1950s, was to make it easier and better for cars, faster and more vehicles through. So, you know, even the idea of jaywalking, right, is not really a concept until about 1930 because people would just walk across the street, right? But it was actually promoted by the motor company, that this idea that, you know, people would obey, that they would listen, that jaywalking was actually a thing that you should not do, again, in order to give priority to the car. And of course, because of the motivation around profits and building more roads for more cars, and basically the industry promoting its own interests, which it turned out, you know, these were not the same interests that the people and many people were revolting. Even back then, they were calling for lower speed limits in the 1920s, and they were calling for speed limiters. This is 100 years ago that'd be fit on motor vehicles. Here we are. We still do not have speed limiters on cars. In fact, we still make cars that can go 200, 250 kilometers an hour. So in some ways, it's actually a little bit disappointing because we could be in a very different place. Once again, our friends in Europe are ahead of us. They actually are looking at, implementing speed limiters on all motor vehicles, all new motor vehicles. There's still a lot more that we'd be doing in this country, but I think it's safe to say that, you know, we are slowly moving in the right direction, but again, I feel it's fairly slow.
The idea of speed limiters reminds me that e-bikes, electronic bikes, are sold, regulated and sold with a speed limiter of 40 kilometers an hour, which is quite fast. Yeah. But folks have pointed out that e-bikes weigh about 40 pounds. Motor vehicles weigh 2,500 to 3,500 pounds, depending on the vehicle, maybe more than that. And right. There's no speed limiter on those things. And yet the rationale is exactly the same. If you were to run into somebody at that rate of speed, it could do a significant amount of harm to that individual if they survived.
Absolutely. When we think about how big a motor vehicle is and the amount of kinetic energy it's capable of making, absolutely. And then the fact that we're going to have, I mean, we're seeing a trend as of COVID-19, as everyone probably knows, of people moving away from public transport. It's not a good thing. Public transport is so very good way of moving people around. And hopefully that'll come back. But we are moving toward, you know, more people walking, cycling, which is excellent. As long as it's you, I'm just stating that we want that from private motor vehicles. You have to take place from private motor vehicles to walking and cycling. In some cases, it is. And these micromobility users, which is completely a big thing, e-scooters and e-bikes and that kind of thing. So we actually clearly are seeing much, much more of that. And as these are doing the good work, like Victoria, of building world-class bike lanes, you build it and they will come, is proven. We're seeing more and more. Victoria, you know, keeps setting a record, more people cycling than the year before or than any other year on record. And so, but my point here is that as we have more what we call vulnerable road users, which is basically anybody outside of a motor vehicle, whether a pedestrian, a cyclist, a e-bike, or a construction worker who's on the roadside, anyone doesn't have the protection of a motor vehicle. And we're seeing more vulnerable road users. And if you see more and more vulnerable road users, we have to look very carefully at the way we design our streets and the way we set speeds and the fact we're putting the priority on them, not people in motor vehicles. Because if you're in a motor vehicle, I mean, the odds of being killed in the city are actually pretty slim. Because you, as a motor vehicle occupant in a modern car with seat belts and airbags, serious injury needs to be, will only occur at quite high speeds, you know, generally. Given if we want to have cities that are livable places and where there are people and there are people, you know what, getting around in these different modes, and we have to recalibrate the priority that we're giving these road users. And that means space, the division of space, and the same speeds.
If you were in a position to offer guidance to the directors of engineering or the municipal councils of the world, what would be the most important things you'd want them to understand about the way we use our roads and the interventions we could put in place to save lives and reduce serious injuries?
I mean, it all starts with thinking differently, you know, because even the idea of Vision Zero, obviously, this is critical, I feel. It's the idea that we would eliminate injuries, serious injuries and deaths, right? But that definition, by the way, before I get into the answer to your question, is important because it's not just eliminating, it's not eliminating all accidents. It's not eliminating all, and we won't do that. There'll always be injuries whenever there's movement, right? People, but we want to eliminate serious injuries, deaths. And but there are a lot of people will say, oh, Vision Zero, pie in the sky and all that stuff. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that they don't appreciate what the definition is. And B, they might not be aware of all the things that are going on in the world. Hundreds of cities have achieved zero pedestrian and cyclist fatalities. if I were to advise the officials around what to do, I would first want to actually convince them that we could eliminate deaths and serious injuries, and it's highly realistic. It's highly realistic to do so. No, this is, again, this is not a wicked problem. The way we design our roads and the way we manage our roads, it's all a human-made system. And road injuries are a human-made, are a result from a human-made system, and there are human-made solutions. We have built it, we have designed it, and we can make it work any way we want to. We are in the driver's seat in the biggest way possible. That would be the most fundamental message, I think. Along with the fact that if we need to think differently, it's not the 1950s anymore. And the idea of, you know, we have to make it so that cars can travel fast and we need to move cars through. This is so backwards. We know through decades now that, you know, the law of induced demand, right? The more we make roads more attractive for cars, the more cars will actually appear on those roads. The more people will drive, the more we make driving attractive. And the same happens in reverse, or the opposite happens in reverse. When we narrow roads or reduce the amount of volume that roads can handle, traffic literally disappears. Last year, the aqueduct in Seattle, they went down, and they were worried what would happen to all those cars. And miraculously, they disappeared, and they couldn't figure out what happened. Like on day one, right? They thought it would be just such a big problem. The people changed their behavior. Again, many different ways. They make less trips. They decide, they alter the time of their trips, or they simply alter the mode. I mean, there are three other huge modes. They can walk, cycle, take public transit. They're better for human health because people are getting physical activity. People are actually socially connected. They're more safe generally, as long as we've designed the system to be safe. But regardless, the fewer cars we have on the road, the fewer deaths there are, the fewer injuries there are. It's better for climate change, and you know it's much better than even electric cars will be, because electric cars, people sometimes think that's the solution to the climate change. But as long as we have electric cars, we'll need roads. Roads require concrete. Concrete, manufacturing of concrete, generates greenhouse gases, and even electric vehicles that generate particulate pollution in terms of brake wear and tire wear and that kind of thing. Really, if we want to protect the environment, make our communities more livable and sustainable, we actually have to move away from motor vehicle travel. So I think one of the things actually that I've always been so exciting about, you know, road safety generally, is that there's so much potential here for doing things differently and actually saving lives and reducing injuries to people.
Neil Arison, the book is No Accident. Thank you so much for spending the time with us today. Really appreciate the benefit of your perspective and the hopeful message that you leave for us. I mean, this is a serious, often morbid subject matter, but it doesn't have to be treated that way. And I really appreciate the optimism that you bring to it about what's possible.
Well, thank you so much, Dean, for having me on your podcast. I really appreciate it.
This has been another episode of The Amazing Places. Thanks so much for listening. Check back again next week when we'll have more for you. Until then, let's get out there and enjoy these amazing places.